Hello, and welcome to episode 150 of Ribbon of Memes, a podcast where we interrogate films previously described by other bards as masterpieces. I am joined, as ever, by Roger.
I'm really glad you resisted that old Giants of Cinema quip, that it seems so obvious.
And we are joined by special guest from Sister Podcast, can I say that? Interactive...
It's somewhere in the general area of Roger, yes.
Somewhere in the general area of
Roger's
Roger.
Podcasting empire.
Patent applied for.
We have Michael Cool, who not only is an authority on all things role-playing, as in interactive radio
theatre. I'm an authority on all things, let me tell you.
It's just an authority in general. As an esteemed actor, he is going to help Roger and I out, because... we are doing our first Shakespeare, sort of. Well, no, I think it's fair to call this Shakespeare.
Shakespeare adjacent, Shakespeare derived.
Shakespeare derived, but very, well, we'll talk about this. We are Orson Welles again in his 1965 possible maddest masterpiece, Falstaff, Chimes at Midnight, or just Chimes at Midnight, as I've seen it.
Most of Europe, it came out under Falstaff. UK right. And US, it was Chimes at Midnight. Shrug.
I think Europe knows the opera better than and needs a hint.
Ah.
Well, that I am not well. So this is a play. I guess it's not a play, but it is a play. It was a play.
It was a play. It's from a play.
It was two separate theatre productions by Orson Welles. So we'll come back to that.
Actually, let me qualify that. It is from plays.
From
a minimum
play.
Of three.
Yeah.
Well, what it is a mashup of the, I believe it's called the Henriade,
can I go back? The theatre history for this
yes.
is that Welles was putting together a series of plays, a series of the, of Shakespeare's history plays. I can't remember whether he started with Richard II.
I think
The original plan for the 1939 production was a single huge production called Five Kings.
Five Kings.
Which was going to go all the way from Richard II to Richard III, so fire all the Henrys. Well, the Royal
Henrys. Yeah, that proved a little overambitious.
Yeah, he got in Burgess Meredith as Hal. He was going to be Falstaff. He was always going to be Falstaff. And they spent most of the time going off drinking and not actually, you know, rehearsing or anything like that. it had a few performances. I think the Theatre Guild cut their ties with the Mercury Theatre as
now,
a result.
This was back in the Mercury Theatre days.
Yeah, this is the year 40s. After the War of the Worlds. You know, they're riding
so it was
hard.
30s even, wasn't it? Yeah, late 30s.
Yeah, this is 39 when this comes on. But yeah, it was not a success.
But then he rejigged it as Chimes at Midnight, which is a smaller in scope, but still a mashup of the...
Yeah, well, hang on. Five Kings was cut down during production to essentially this size of story, which I think we could call roughly Henry IV parts 1 and 2.
And a dash of Henry V.
Yeah.
And a bit of Merry Wives of Windsor.
So really? that was what originally... got put on in 39. Then he revived it in 1960 again as a stage production. This time with Kevin Baxter, we'll talk about later, who's in the film as well. He basically decided Kevin Baxter was the right man for Hal.
Well, we shall decide whether he was.
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
But that was all similarly successful, as I understand.
It wasn't quite as much of a disaster as the 39 production. But
come on! It says the tech run wasn't completed, and it ran until dawn the next day. I got twinges in my old actor's bones.
I'm sorry if it was painful to revisit.
It was. It was. It reminded me of the days. It looks like an unmitigated disaster with him again, not paying attention to detail and just having grand ideas.
See, I've read some suggestions that after Citizen Kane, he kind of, it's probably not true, but he kind of sabotaged himself and was never a perfectionist again. So he'd never run the risk of putting out a perfected product, so he could always blame the that sort of thing it, on why it wasn't
it's a
perfect.
Deeply psychologically interesting hypothesis, but I think he was just overimpressed with himself.
Who told this story and were his initials OW?
Yeah, I think that when he did Citizen Kane, he was given not only what he called the best train set a boy could ever play with.
Yes,
but he was given the assistance of a studio of technicians and engineers and artists who knew how to make his mad imaginings real.
So when he says, "I want these shots looking up at the ceiling," they say, "Tricky, but we can do it."
Yeah. Whereas a normal film director, because he was a theatre director at that time. Anyway, and moving on,
and as we are hearing, not in the event a terribly successful one.
Well, he managed to, despite the complete lack of success of the various stage plays, he managed to convince a Spanish financier to give him money because he was going to make a version of Treasure Island.
Yeah, basically.
And while he was there, he'd have a go at the Chimes of Midnight.
He
as well.
Started off saying, "I want to do this," and the Spanish producer said, "Yeah, it's not commercial, but all right, you know, make me a Treasure Island, and then you can make this in parallel with it because you've got essentially one film's worth of budget that you can split over two films because you're a genius. You tell me so all the time."
Yeah.
I think by this point he may have been identifying rather too closely with Falstaff.
He was certainly a method actor, if nothing else.
I think he just got the idea of lying and doing anything to get what he wanted too firmly fixed into his head.
It was supposed to be the same cast, the same sets to be used in the two.
Yeah, they were all cast as, like, he was Long John Silver and I think Jim Hawkins.
The tavern would be the Admiral Benbow as well.
It looks nothing like
the Admiral Benbow.
Never had any pretensions of actually making Treasure Island.
I mean, they didn't actually write a script or anything.
Yeah. One wonders where the producer's men were.
It was the 60s, man.
I guess the idea of Chimes of Midnight is all written by Shakespeare. It's just mashed up. There are a few lines of dialogue that aren't Shakespeare, and that's because they were from the Holinshed's Chronicles, which was just a narration of history. But that's maybe three or four sentences, not very much.
Holinshed's Chronicles are by scholar types, reckoned to be one of Shakespeare's primary sources for the histories. Though I was going to mention some of his primary sources for the histories were histories that plays that other people had written.
Well, that's an interesting thing for me, because I am not well-versed in Shakespeare. My experience of Shakespeare, I'm afraid, was doing The Merchant of Venice in English, and that is... it's not his best play, I think it's fair to say. I've discovered that later, but it was enough to put me off as a schoolboy.
You had The Merchant of Venice, you should have tried doing Winter's Tale, which I did. But if you want to be put off Shakespeare, have a Winter's Tale assigned to you at school.
Well, fortunately not. I was in a period where Shakespeare was slightly out of favour, so that was the only one we touched in my whole childhood. I think it's a hard Shakespeare, for me at least, it's hard to read, it's much better seen performed, generally.
I think that's true, now that I look back at it more, I think for an audience of adolescent boys, I also obviously had Shakespeare at school, I think it was Merchant and Comedy of Errors, the comedies work much better because it's about the right level of humour.
Yeah, it's not highbrow, is it, at that point? No.
Plenty of knob jokes. He put two knob jokes into the sonnet, so...
Shall I compare thee? Anyway,
thou hast thy will. And will means willy in that particular case.
So everyone was sniggering at I see. Very good. That is about our level. That's a Watson Hall level of... Okay.
Talking of sister podcasts as we were.
Talking of sister podcasts. So I come to this from a slightly unusual perspective, or at least maybe slightly unusual, in that I know the actual history probably better than I know the plays at all. And so which is not that I don't know that much about Henry the Fourth and Henry the Fifth, but I know a bit, and what little I know is not from Shakespeare; it's from history.
Well, as you may reflect, this particular production is almost has the history in the background,
yes,
but not in the foreground. Well, the foreground is Falstaff.
Most of the ground of the film. I mean, so what the film does is it takes Henry the Fourth, parts one and two, the Henry cinematic universe, I guess, and mashes them together, and then basically pairs it back mostly to the relationship between Falstaff and the young Prince Hal, soon to be Henry the Fifth, and Henry the Fourth and Prince Hal. I don't know that Falstaff and they do meet briefly, Falstaff and Henry the Fourth, but not.
This isn't a positive interaction.
No.
And that's the play, really. So, and the way it's done is, or the film, I should say, the way it's done is by entirely using Shakespeare's dialogue, but occasionally transposing it to different characters or making them refer to different people than the original play did.
Yeah, and it cuts out stuff. Prodigiously. It's only using the battle and politics from the first part of Henry the Fourth. The second part gets extracted very deeply. They lose a lot of characters. Owen Glyndwr, to this quarter Welshman's disgust, is gone. So is the Scot, who is much more tedious as backers of Percy. And Hotspur gets basically to be the moving force of the entire rebellion, which is
isn't a bad decision,
but it does chop the play up a bit.
Owen Glyndwr started the rebellion, didn't he? I think.
Well, Owen Glyndwr was refusing to be British or English, as he would have seen at the time. The last Prince of Wales. He was still up there in the hills. Anyway, history. You wanted to talk about actual history.
Well, I guess the problem with history, or looking at history of this period, is because the Shakespeare plays of this time loom so large, I do think history has been influenced by Shakespeare's plays somewhat, and it's occasionally hard to work out what actually happened.
Yeah.
I mean, the actual background is that Henry the Fourth had deposed Richard the Second in a slightly dubious claim of...
Wait till Richard was out of the country, which is always a sure sign that you have a solid legal case.
So he was always on slightly shaky ground, or always trying to prove himself.
In the play, he's depicted as more worried about the moral ground that he finds himself in, and that and rebelling against a lawful prince is about as bad as you can get. And the trouble is, at this moment in time, the queen was, let's see now, 2-3 generations away from another person who'd taken the crown away forcibly. He was treading on delicate ground doing this at all.
She is well renowned for her sense of humour about such matters,
and hardly ever thought about putting Shakespeare in the Tower at all.
It's just flat out says that he killed off Henry the Fourth, killed off Richard the Second. I guess he did, but it was years after the deposition. Anyway, that's the background to history, and that we have this slightly shaky ground, which is why there's a rebellion at all, I guess. But as you say, the history is pretty much denuded, and either assumed that you already know it, or it's just very quickly filled in.
It's all about, in this, it's all about Percy's outrage that the king won't liberate his relative, who used to be the heir to the throne before Richard got off. From being the prisoner of Owen Glyndwr.
That's the reason Richard was off, really, wasn't it, to cut that line of succession?
But in turn, I think what that feeds into this is that Hal is the notorious, asking about not preparing to be an heir. and that Henry, brackets four, feels that this is undermining his own position because he is, yeah, as a usurper, he is very sensitive to the idea that I need to present an image of stability. You know, it's not just me, it's my son, and then only his son, and so on.
And he fears that in killing a wastrel king, he has brought the curse of having a wastrel son on himself.
Well, this is one of Shakespeare's things, which is fully present in Chimes at Midnight, which is, I wish I'd had Hotspur instead of you, basically. So Hotspur is the Percy's young, dashing prince type, except he's not a prince, but he's the one who Henry the Fourth, and I think this is straight out of Henry the Fourth, part one, is, if only we could swap, yeah. If only someone had come and swapped you as kids, which is really nice to hear as a Prince Hal.
Makes you feel warm, doesn't it?
Yes.
But which is odd from my point of view, because Percy can be played and is being played here as a bit of a clown. He is noble, he is brave, he's also a bit of a plonker. Yeah. And his nickname Hotspur is justified because he'll go off at any provocation. And his uncle, I think he is Worcester, says, don't tell him what the king offered to us at one stage. Don't tell him we've got a possibility of peace and a one-to-one combat with Prince Hal. Don't tell him.
Just keep it. Because you can't predict what Hotspur will do, or you can predict, which is part of the problem. So that's kind of one aspect of this kind of triangle, if you like, in that there's this jealousy between Hal and Hotspur, and this disdain for Hal. We all call them different names because they're all called Harry, which is very confusing.
Yeah, or
they're all called Henry. And then the other part of the triangle is Falstaff, which is, I think, an entirely fictional character.
All right, let me go off on this. There was a man called Sir John Oldcastle, who was an associate of Hal during his youth. He was not a coward. He was a notable and brave commander during the suppression of Owen Glyndwr. And he was very much a favourite of the king, and he lived into Henry V's lifetime. Unfortunately, he had become an heretic, to wit, a Lollard, follower of John Wycliffe, and a believer in, well, most of the things that the Protestant Reformation eventually ended up doing. And Sir John Oldcastle ended up in the Tower, managed to escape with the help of another Lollard, and then went about the country, forming a Lollard revolution in order to overthrow everybody, execute the entire nobility, and pay their money to his followers.
As we can see, this was a complete success.
Yes.
Yeah, well, eventually he got captured again, and as he had been condemned as a heretic before escaping, they decided to not bother with any further trial and just chopped his head off.
Well, so you don't need a trial for that kind of bastard.
All right. So in the play I was mentioning, the first version of the life of King Henry V that was on the English stage, which Shakespeare appears to have known about, Sir John Oldcastle is depicted as this debauched companion of the king's youth who is, and I'm not sure if this is in Holinshed, well, what source it has at all, is encouraging the king to drink and whore and all that sort of thing. And Shakespeare took this, and in the original manuscripts and in the original performances, it seems that he was called Sir John Oldcastle, Shakespeare's character. Unfortunately, Sir John Oldcastle was also known as Baron Cobham in his, he was allowed to attend Parliament as a baron because his wife held the title. And there were still Baron Cobhams about, and they were still big important people. And Baron Cobham sort of lost it at seeing his relative by marriage, if nothing else, depicted this way on a stage. And so Shakespeare felt he had to rename the character. And he, in order not to confuse anybody, he took the name of somebody who lived in the reign of King Henry VI and was a commander of in the wars against Joan of Arc. Sir John Fastolf twisted it about a bit and made it Falstaff.
Talking of objects as we were.
Yeah, but it is to be noted that Sir John Fastolf got the reputation for cowardice because he allowed himself to be beaten by Joan of Arc, which I think is a little unfair.
That's my
scholarly
history of the fictional.
Yeah, and one other thing to note: Lord Shakespeare's company were called the Lord Chamberlain's Men. The Lord Chamberlain was their protector, the person who said they weren't just rogues and vagabonds and wandering players who could be arrested at the slightest provocation, just like today. And and eventually the old Lord Chancellor died and the Queen made Lord Cobham Lord Chancellor. Not Lord Chancellor, Lord Chamberlain, I'm sorry.
Right.
And the Chamberlain's men had a very sticky year until he died in his turn. All right, that's the full story.
So it's a very political move of Shakespeare to come up with Falstaff.
Well, it was very politically stupid to not check whether somebody still had descendants.
Well, he was pumping these plays out at quite some rate at that time.
It's
true,
yeah. He didn't
have too much time to do research. So, Falstaff in the play, at least, is in this film. I keep calling it a play because...
It feels like one.
Yeah. Is this immense, like, the film... I think I read somewhere rather cruelly that someone said Orson Welles may at this point be the only person too big to play John Falstaff, which is a bit harsh. I don't know whether he was exaggerated a bit or that was his actual size, but he is this immense figure, and the camera goes many lengths to kind of exaggerate his size. I think he's often filling most of the screen.
Before we started recording, I was mentioning that the European poster, at least, has this towering figure.
Mm. It's not subtle, is it? The two women in the piece, I guess they're the only two women cowering beneath him. So he's this, debauched, drunk, liar, coward.
Thief.
A paragon of virtue.
Though I think, even at the beginning, that the Wells is trying to get a slightly different spin on it. I mean, yes, there is this idea to rob the... Is it pilgrims?
Pilgrims, yeah.
Yes.
But he's going for a straightforward, honest robbery, whereas Hal has got this other plan.
It's Poins's plan to start off with. The aim of the entire thing is to see what lies Falstaff will tell after the event. And they do get a magnificent string of lies.
They do. That's one of my favourite scenes from the film, is that they are some wonderful lies. So I agree. I don't know. In Shakespeare, is Falstaff basically... So he's to clarify, in Shakespeare's plays, he's a recurring character in three or four plays, I think.
Three plays with a mention in a fourth.
And is he just a flat-out comedy character in the plays, or...?
Well, this is where I'm going to disagree with Orson Welles. I think Welles had, by this point, fallen in love with Falstaff so intensely.
Yes.
And with his own performance as Falstaff so intensely that he didn't quite get a lot of the stuff that's going on. Falstaff, I think, is almost playing a vice, one of the embodiments of sin from the old morality plays.
Gluttony, sloth, perhaps a bit of lust.
Gluttony, sloth, and lust have always been my favourites.
Greed as well.
Greed. He's a liar. He is the opposite of a good knight. What a nobleman is supposed to be. He's predatory. He does have affections. He is charming. He is witty. But Orson Welles, in my opinion, is playing him as closer to Mr. Pickwick than what Shakespeare puts in the play. Welles, I think, sees himself as a lovable rogue,
Yeah. I
mean, if you're going to go around cheating film producers when you're in the film business, you pretty much have to be. And I think he's projecting onto Falstaff sympathy and virtue that isn't there.
So in the plays, Falstaff is a comedy villain in a way.
I'd say so. Okay.
Also, I think it's fairly important to the progress of Hal that he eventually drop Falstaff and try to become a good king.
Yeah, but bear in mind that a good king isn't a sympathetic figure.
Mm.
In Henry V, King Henry is charming, witty, and uses all the charm and wit that he may have picked up from Falstaff in his command and in his wooing of the French princess. But here he is cold, and here the king he becomes is not a sympathetic person. But then,
well, I guess that's the whole point of the film, is that we, in a way, is this transition from Hal as this warm, lovable rogue himself to this cold, imperious monarch.
I think Hal is a very ambiguous figure here. He's one of the lads, but he's not, and his motivations remain very obscure to me, and he has a speech which this film incidentally ruins, which explains it. But I've never really understood what Hal thinks he is doing and how he excuses his behaviour to himself.
I'm glad you say that, because he feels like he's the character that is hard to understand and sympathise with, at least in the context of the film, because he just. It's frustrating. There are a lot of reasons why I guess he would change and become a king, but it never felt well explained. I mean, I guess that the film is supposed to be a tragedy, and the tragedy is really the breaking of friendship between Falstaff and Hal, I think. That feels like the whole point of the film.
For Orson Welles, certainly it was.
But
this is just a side event in the pageantry of the history, in the full plays.
Yes,
but it is the most affecting, the most human moment in the plays.
But Hal is an awkward character, because he's really mercurial in that one minute he's playing along and happy, and the next moment he is.
Touch me not! I am the king. I am the prince.
Yeah, exactly. And you don't know whether he's doing that ironically or now, is that the fault of Shakespeare, or is that the fault of Henry IV? Keith Baxter?
Kevin Baxter, who very nearly played Octavian opposite Elizabeth Taylor.
But scheduling problems. Or she got ill and then he missed his window.
I don't know. I think there's probably some... I think there's probably some blame to be laid on Orson Welles here. But it's also a very difficult part.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to reconcile. There are one of the plays I did for A-Level was Measure for Measure. And that's a play in which the central character, the Duke, who's disguised himself as a monk for reasons that pass understanding, is a very unsympathetic character because he is all virtue, all judgmental morality. And yet you are expected to feel that he is in some sense the hero of the piece. And for modern audiences, it's very, very difficult. I think there are probably better Prince Hals, but the problem isn't all with the actor. He does some nice things.
He does very effectively change his face from the cheerful roistering to the, as you say, touch me not, I'm the king. It's something I've noticed, particularly since we started doing this, that little bit of non-verbal physical acting that maybe isn't in the script, maybe the director suggested it, but it's often a sign of an actor's performance. I really appreciate that they managed to do that effectively.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. You can tell which mode he's in. I suppose for me, the issue is he switches between those modes very quickly. Mm. And that makes the final betrayal less of a surprise and less affecting to me, I guess.
I think from the moral point of view, you're supposed to see it not as a betrayal, but as a just renunciation, as him finally doing the decent thing.
Well, in Shakespeare you are.
I was going to say, that isn't how Wells sees it, as far as I can tell.
I think that may be part of the problem, because what he's trying to do here is convey a message very different from what Shakespeare's was. In other words, that this is the great betrayal, and yes, he's trying to do it with, as far as possible, the original words.
Entirely with the original words.
I don't think that's a problem. I think it's there because Shakespeare is never monotonal. He never has only one thing to say in his characters. Don't have the two-dimensionalness that will be necessary for that sort of moralizing plodding. That there is a right on both sides is what makes the scene so affecting.
And now I have some. I had a few difficulties. Partially, I do think it helps to be a little trained or experienced in Shakespeare to get into the rhythm of the verbiage. You know, it's
the voids,
the weight of it. Yeah, and to recognise a lot of the time you're just trying to follow along actually what they're saying to some extent. That is not helped by the fact the soundtrack to this film is pretty dismal.
The soundtrack appears to have been, as far as I can tell, maybe with the exception of some of Wells's lines, appears to have been entirely redubbed, and you can tell by the sound quality.
But sometimes it's not quite in sync.
Well, I wasn't looking for that, but the sound quality in your ear, something recorded live, has depth and has things going on in the background. You can tell. You may be in a carefully curated room where the sound is limited, but you're not in a booth in a recording studio sometime later. Some of it he had to re-record because the actors had non-English accents and he wanted something consistent. I think that there's two of the actors.
I think Worcester, the character, entirely redubbed.
And one other, I think, got entirely redubbed. But almost all of it, the sound quality they got out of the shooting in Spain wasn't good enough. And maybe it's just that Wells is really good at recording in a sound studio. Maybe it's because his lines got better care, which is a cruel thing to say, Michael. But you can hear that it's not natural sound. It's not it's not live, and it doesn't quite work as decent sound would do. Because he was on a terribly low budget. Ran out of that, by the way.
Well, consequently, I found it hard to. Then I found some subtitles that worked, but then a part of the problem then is it's so verbose that a lot of the time I was just reading along, listening without really watching the film. So some of the scenes I had to rewind to look at the visuals.
I think to do this, it is dense, and sometimes the jokes especially need footnotes, but
I actually spotted one of them, which was one I was quite happy about. Where the thing about Doll's tear sheet is already in hell and she's burning. Yes, that is a reference to Syphilitic Sores. Thank you very much.
I remember the line. I didn't go there, so to speak.
Shakespeare makes a lot of jokes about venereal diseases, in Measure for Measure especially.
Did you find that, Roger, as well? Was it harder to follow not being terribly Shakespearean?
I do find it easy to get into the Shakespearean dialogue style, or monologue style, as it often is, because it is, when they allow it to be the poetry that it is, which obviously does not sound like naturalistic dialogue, and when they're doing naturalistic dialogue, that was pretty rough, as you're saying, because the sound quality. When they get into the long poetic bits, the good old pentameter, then I had no trouble with that at all.
I guess once I'm into it, I do find myself slightly thinking along those lines as well, which is, so I think it is a slightly different mode to our modern speech.
Yeah, well, it is, but they've got John Gielgud here. He's giving he's giving very good value, and I do hope he got paid for this.
I did like his, I'm paraphrasing that, I can't sleep speech. That was quite a good one.
Yeah. All right, hang on. This is something I wanted to say about soliloquies. Orson Welles seems to have taken a hatred for soliloquies.
Right.
In this piece. He has rejigged at least three that I spotted so that they're actually not being addressed to the audience or to himself, but to another character.
Okay.
And this doesn't... Excuse me, am I allowed an expletive or do I have to delete it?
You can expletive.
Oh, yeah, there's only one tag on iTunes, which is this sweary or is it not? And everything I do, I just set that tag. It's simpler.
It is not fucking working! there are three scenes. There's where Prince Hal soliloquizes about his true motivations early on it.
That's quite early in the film.
That's quite early in the film. And he's doing it with Falstaff in the background. And the only way that works is if Falstaff has been suddenly struck and deaf and can no longer understand what he's saying, because Falstaff ought to burst in. There's the moment where Falstaff does his speech about, oh, I have abused the king's press dreadfully. If I'm not ashamed of my men, I'm a soused gurnet. He's got this line of useless people.
Useful press
soldiers who he's taking to the wars. And he does it in the face of the Lord Chief Justice of England and the Archbishop of Canterbury, who ought to have him arrested the instant he confesses to this. And then finally, Falstaff's great speech about what is honour, a word, what is a word, a breath.
Oh, I love that speech.
It's a wonderful speech. But it should not be addressed to Prince Hal.
Yeah, I have to. That's probably not the person to say it to.
And the actor whose name we keep forgetting, who's playing Prince Hal,
Kevin Baxter.
He stands there looking nobly with his face in three-quarter profile. Looking nobly, as if he's not hearing a word of it.
As if he is one of his nice shredding.
And what set me off on this was the fact that even Orson Welles didn't have the nerve to take his soliloquy away from John Gielgud.
Well, I was going to say, the only person who does get one is Henry IV with his...
I cannot sleep. Where's my son? My poor suffering subjects when he comes.
He knocks it out of the park as well, I thought. That's his comfort zone, I guess.
You expect it to be. I will say, right at the start of the film, well, not the first sequence, which we ought to come back to, but the first court scene after the titles, you've got the king on the throne addressing his court. And I felt if there was ever a moment that demanded a close-up of John Gielgud, that was it, and we didn't get one.
Well, I wondered if the point was to show him quite lonely, actually quite small in this giant surroundings, a bit like a prisoner.
But you still want to see his face as you never get more than a medium long shot. In that scene.
In his soliloquy, he gets
a close-up. But I think this is part of where the sheer financial difficulties of the thing comes through. It's another point at which it could have been done better with more time. And
I think they had a lot of conflicting schedules and a lot of the actors weren't there at certain points.
Yeah, they only had Margaret Rutherford for 4 days, which, considering what she managed to belt out in that time, is quite remarkable.
She was great in it, I thought.
I think, I got problems with her. I've got problems with a fair bit of the cast. She's good, but she is too respectable to be keeping a whorehouse. And the fact that she's so respectable, the speech about the house being full of needle women, which I suddenly realise is where Terry Pratchett got that from, is you lose the joke because...
Absolutely you did, because I'm going to admit, I thought the only prostitute there was, what's her name, Dolly?
Dolly.
And that Margaret Rutherford was being sincere and that she genuinely had a respectable pub. So I think that's proven your point.
Yeah, and I kept thinking, at several points in it, I thought, gosh, there's a healthy lot of young whores in that whorehouse.
Not just Jeanne Moreau, who is frankly gorgeous, but
yes,
yes,
yeah. But she's allowed out to be, and she's specifically playing a fallen woman who doesn't quite regret it. I think on the whole, Margaret Rutherford does that last speech, the one after Falstaff's death, really well.
Yes, I found that quite moving. Yeah,
yeah, but I also thought, hang on, where's her accent going now? Is she Irish?
And she did go quite Irish in the last one, I have to admit.
I'm told that's one of the few bits I read somewhere. It's one of the few bits of the actual recorded at the time dialogue, because he Orson Welles thought that was the best thing. She could have done. I'm not going to re-record that.
Well, that might be why we had a wandering accent. Maybe she changed it later and then forgot. We should talk about the battle scene, the Battle of Shrewsbury, because that is considered one of the finest cinematic battle scenes. How did we feel about that? So this is the face-off between Henry IV and the rebellion, the Percys, and it's a huge medieval battle, and it's where Prince Hal...
Well, it's definitely not huge. That's one of the things.
Did it work as a huge medieval battle? Because extras.
Your Shakespearean film with a battle in it prior to this, or your medieval set film with a battle in it prior to this, will make a point of showing the ranks drawn up and the huge army and so on, which is obviously very expensive. And this is very careful not to do that. It's not... Here is the commanding view of the battle as one of the people running it, which is a bit of a fake anyway, but never mind. It's here is the frankly terrifying individual experience of all these people are trying to kill me.
Yes.
Yeah, I think the intention is good. He's got three groups of extras and actors that he can use. He's got the people on horseback who charge backwards and forwards and left and right. And play both sides, and that's a very impressive sight. And I'm sure he's glad he's got them. He's got some archers, because after Laurence Olivier's Henry V, he's got to have some archers. and he's got the poor bloody infantry, including the bunch of useless pressed men that Falstaff brought up. I think I can see what he's doing, but I think it would have worked better if he'd had a tighter focus on individual people and on their individual fates, rather than. It's good, but it could have been better, and I think it went on a bit, or maybe it was just me pausing in the middle of it and my computer restarting from the start of the scene.
I think it was. A new way of doing things as far as battles on film were concerned, and for that reason people said, wow, it's amazing. But I think, as we've said before on Ribbon of Memes, often the first film to do something doesn't actually do it terribly well, and everybody imitates it, and this is the standard way to do things, and you look at the original again, and it's okay, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's a direct line from this to the Saving Private Ryan opening, which we really should watch, Roger. I wouldn't say enjoyed it, but this sense of the battle just being like all the verbiage, all the verbosity and the poetry is stopped, and it's just this kind of meat grinder. You just see people being destroyed by it. It worked for me as this kind of, this is actually what, there's none of this nobility and poetry anymore. It's just people desperately trying to kill each other.
Yeah. And then suddenly, Hal and Hotspur face off, and you're back in poetry territory.
Well, that was the only, because it looks very much like Hotspur gets a longsword in the throat in the in the battle, but then he's still able to do a nice bit of a dying poetry before he... That broke it a bit for me, because, you know, in a modern film, there'd just be blood everywhere, and he'd be gasping and gurgling his way through his last moment. Yeah. But no, he looks largely untouched and gets a nice death scene.
Yeah.
But then we're back into...
All right, I did squawk a bit when I saw the armour hoists, because that was only ever used for jousting armour.
Oh, yeah.
And
I thought that the Laurence Olivier is to blame for that.
And then they turn it into a sort of a comedy scene with Falstaff.
Well, that's what it's supposed to be. Falstaff comes along and tries to steal the credit. And is willing to accept an earldom if he doesn't get off of the duke.
Falstaff's lies in there, I have to say, they're pretty impressive. I really like the lying scene after the comedy. That's a prank that could have gone very badly wrong. The comedy robbery at the beginning.
Yeah.
But it's worth it for his massively exaggerated lies.
I think they could have done that better, but maybe it worked better on the small expanse of a stage.
Right.
Than it does in the middle of a bloody great forest when you're running to the side. Actually, that which reminds me, I had a note to say. Though I have quarrels with Wells's direction here, see my earlier comments about close-ups, he's made magnificent use of the castles and buildings in Spain. And his location finding person really deserves a huge credit here. He does waste some of it with a lot of pointless medieval foo-fra of people riding about on horses. And yes. I'm really not at all sympathetic to the scene with Hotspur in his bath. How many bloody trumpeters does one nobleman need?
There's a lot. They cut away at least three too many times to trumpeters. I agree.
But the darkness and the light in the castles, in the palace, and the set of the inn is too much. But
I quite like the way that Falstaff is squeezed into these tiny corridors. Again, it's all emphasizing how giant he is. I mean, that's an incredibly big pub. House.
Yeah, they needed a big club to fit Falstaff into it, obviously. Or maybe they just happened to have the budget.
I agree. I mean, there's the close-ups are almost entirely of Orson Welles for the most part. He gets all the best. But I cinematographically, which is a word, I did like it. Some films put me at ease quite quickly with how they look, and this is one of those. I felt quite happy going into it. How did we... So I suppose we've talked about different aspects. Let's return then, as we get towards the end, to the main point of it. Did it work for you, this triangle, Falstaff and Henry IV and Hal? Did that... Because I guess, to me, it was all building up to that scene where Falstaff breaks through during the coronation and Henry IV rejects him.
Yeah.
For me, that was the essence of the sort of comedy I don't like. In other words, here is the silly man. Everybody else knows that he is the silly man who is getting it wrong, but he persists in doing it. I can too easily see myself as the silly man in this situation. So I start to feel that maybe Wells felt the same way. But, you know, frankly, perhaps people have been laughing at him. Either in person or as a director. But it's that similar, that desperate feeling of, all right, yeah, he's, Falstaff is perhaps realizing that things are not going right, but he's got nothing, he's got no option but to carry on with it, because that's what he's committed himself to.
So did you feel it was sort of a comedic scene at the end?
Yes, it is the moment where comedy trips over into embarrassment, into shame. Falstaff has been riding high throughout this, at least in his own mind, and he has been turning aside all the challenges to his dignity, to his self-image, and he has bet his life, as it turns out, on the friendship of the prince and being able to cash in. The thing that the moment when he hears, he starts listing the good things he's going to bring to his companions, and then ends with, "And woe unto my lord, Chief Justice of England, because vengeance." And he's not a nice person.
Yes, yeah.
Is the bit at the end? I used to use Falstaff's speech from the throne, whereas imitating the king as my audition piece. And very little work it got me ever. But I perhaps identify, being as I am, a goodly, portly man and a corpulent, I identify with Falstaff a fair bit, but I identify him with him as a sinner and a rogue and a vagabond. And he's being set up by the author and by fate to take a terrible fall at the end. And there's been laughter. There's a good deal of forced laughter and forced jollity in this production. There's been laughter in the past and good fellowship, and now everything breaks and everything falls apart around him. And you're right. It's, technically speaking, it's not a tragedy, but it's an immense sadness. I don't know what the right word is for a piece that expresses the vulnerability and failure of being a human being. But that last scene between Falstaff and the king, it has it.
For me, it did work in that I felt emotions, you know, during that scene, which is rare for a film nowadays. You know, I did feel sorry for Falstaff. I agree, though, there's been literally some heavy lifting to get us there, to feel sympathy for Falstaff. So am I right in the original play, then, our sympathies are more, or at least supposed to be, with Prince Hal?
I don't think so. I don't think it's that simple. I think it's Shakespeare.
Yeah, this is Shakespeare, and he never does anything straightforward except the bits with the clowns, which he probably didn't actually write.
They're not your clowns, say more than he's put down for.
I liked it. It did work for me.
And that's certainly the side of it that Wells is trying to emphasise.
I think what I would have liked to have seen... not to tell Shakespeare how to write, but this wasn't the point of Shakespeare, is some, and it was hard for Wells to put this in because Shakespeare presumably didn't write a scene like this, is a scene where Hal realises kind of what he's done to Falstaff.
It is sort of there. He takes bits of Henry V, and Henry is setting off, he's no sooner crowned, and that happens quickly. He's no sooner crowned than he is setting off for France. Off to Agincourt, though he doesn't know that yet. And Wells puts a speech from that into Henry's mouth, which appears to be him finally forgiving Falstaff, but Falstaff is dead by that point. Prince King Henry does nothing of the kind. King Henry V.
Yeah.
It's just Wells attempting to make a sentimental, forgiving ending, and it isn't there. But he does make it harsher by dragging Falstaff's death from Henry V into the end of his play, so that Mistress Quickly can have that magnificent speech. Which Margaret Rutherford does pretty well.
Yeah,
I'm certain there's a dirty joke in how she climbs up his body, feeling each part.
And so on. I could see that was the scene that was supposed to be it, but because it was transposed from another play, and because Henry, he's in full Henry V mode there's no Prince Hal left, there's no kind of regret. That's the point.
If I hadn't read that was what Wells was intending to do, I'd have missed it.
Yeah, I agree. And I think I read that after. That for me would complete the tragedy, is that Hal realizing what he's done to his friend. And I think that's why ultimately it didn't quite work for me.
I think we should perhaps consider the parallels with Wells's own life.
Yes.
I'm sure we're not the first people to talk about this, but certainly his father was, I believe the term would be, a bit of a lad.
A Falstaffian figure.
Definitely into the whole drinking and gambling and whoring thing, and would occasionally take the young Orson with him on these trips. Eventually,
education, nothing like it.
Eventually, Orson said essentially, "I'm not going to have anything further to do with you until you reform a bit."
On the advice of his schoolmaster and principal of Harvard, maybe.
Within 6 months, he was a bit young, was dead. So
the last conversation, as far as I understand it, with his dad was, get better, stop drinking, and then I'll have something to do with you.
So I don't think it's a stretch to say that, although obviously Wells is playing Falstaff, he sees himself to some extent as Hal the Betrayer.
Yeah.
And he said, I'm sure that conversation killed my father, in effect, so...
He probably identifies, but I mean, who knows? But he certainly got a strong identification with Falstaff. That's clear.
Mm.
But yeah, it's probably that relationship, I suspect, meant a lot more to him because of that.
I'm reluctant to call it a masterpiece, if that's the question we're coming around to.
Yeah, I think we are coming there, yeah.
Orson Welles, it could have been a great piece if Wells had been either playing Falstaff or directing, but not both at the same time. And on the whole, there are wonderful things in it. And he did the best he could with limited means, but no, it's a curate's egg, I'm afraid. And my lack of sympathy with the sentimental way he sees Falstaff. Sentiment reduces the tragedy, reduces the clash of goods.
Mm.
And I think it's a mistake. There's lots of other things that could have been improved and weren't. But then again, some of that is just the limits of film form when you're not on stage and don't have the time and stretch that the stage allows you.
I think, for me, it's a really interesting experiment. It gets the job done in that it's quite clear to me what Wells wants me to think.
Mm.
But I don't really get on with the way he does it even so. So, yeah. I'm very glad I've seen it. I think I'm very unlikely ever to watch it again.
Yeah, it would just raise my hackles again.
For me, yeah, I think it's a... There are moments of... the battle scene, I do think, was a masterpiece for the time and has influenced the way a lot of films do battles now. I think, a little like Hitchcock with Rope, which we may talk about at some point, the constraint that he couldn't add any additional dialogue and then he had to basically bend Shakespeare, contort Shakespeare to tell what he was trying to do, much like with what Hitchcock did with the Rope, doesn't quite work for me, because it is there, as you say, in Shakespeare, but it's not kind of emphasised in the way Wells wants it. And it did move me, that scene, the final scene that we're all building up to. But I agree. I think, to some extent, Wells is trying to make Falstaff almost a virtuous character, almost virtuous because he's so not virtuous. And I that feels to me like an excuse for a lot of Wells's behaviour, which makes me, which raises my hackles a bit, I guess. So I agree. Not a masterpiece, but very interesting.
I would almost say his Falstaff here is straightforward and consistent, but he is also a thoroughgoing liar, so...
Consistent liar. I don't know. We've got
We can look forward from this point to him making F for fake, which is a very interesting piece about lies and truth and the art world.
We may revisit that, but I think for today, unless anyone's got anything else to say,
I would just like to mention Roger's booze corner, because sack is widely mentioned here, and sack is essentially a fortified white wine, one of the varieties of sack would later become the dominant one and become known as sherry. So
I think there's a Shakespeare line about a good name being this, about a good sherris sack.
Yep. As though that was the one from Jerez, as opposed to the Canary Islands or the other places that it came from. So when you're tossing back a flagon of that, bear in mind, this is not a trivial drink.
I think I'd like to I'd like to mention the oddity I found in the opening, because they cut to scenes at, basically the opening scene is a scene which belongs at the end of this is another quarrel, and basically I don't think the allusion between them talking about the days we had seen then going back in time really quite works. If you don't know, it's another of those things, if you don't know what it is, you're not going to make any sense of it.
I was interested because the scene that it sort of fed, I got that they were sort of reminiscing, but then the scene that it fed back into and the relationship between those two characters wasn't quite what it appears at the start, which maybe was how it was supposed to be, but for that reason it didn't work for me.
Yeah, when they get to the famous actual Trams of Midnight speech, the impression I'm getting is that he's just fed up with these two drunkards.
Yeah.
They have nothing original to say. Yeah, I've heard all that before, and so on.
Whereas they seem sort of firm old companions in the episode. Maybe that's deliberate, but yeah, I agree. That doesn't... unnecessary and a little confusing.
Oh, well.
Oh, well. Never mind. Try again next time, Orson. We will return. Thank you very much for your august company, Mike. That was extremely helpful to get us through some Shakespeare.
All right, I'm glad you liked it. And let me just say in conclusion, peace, good pike pot. Peace, good tickle brain.